grandfather, Daniel Stillman, had founded the Stillman Farm on the road in 1841. Our speaker has been living in the Stillman farmhouse for well over 55 years, which must be something of a historical record for the Okemos population. It is my great pleasure to introduce the author of our mystery book, Ruth Stillman.
Oh, thank you. Boy, I would like to live that long if I was going to keep all my faculty dressing. But thank you again. Can you hear me back there? I'll try to. If I begin to drop my voice, will you put your hand up or something? This crowd sort of overwhelms me tonight. I thought maybe there'd be 25 or 50 people here. She suggested that perhaps you'd like to know how I happened to write the first book, the first little history book. And I told her this afternoon I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember anything about getting started on that book. I looked the date up and the date says 56. All I remember is that Mrs. Marshall worked with me on it. But I can't remember even writing it, so maybe it isn't my book. I think you'd like to do just a very brief history of Okemos. It's in this book, but I will change it a little bit, add some things perhaps that are not in the book. Suppose you go back 140 years,
that's what you were trying to do with me, Okemos.
And you are standing on that high bank across the bridge on Okemos Road, to the right of the bridge. You know the bank is up high. And you're standing there, and all around you is just a dense forest. And then you look down onto the river, and on the other side of the river are some flat lowlands. And then back of those, there's another ridge that goes up, which is the place where our present Hamilton Road goes along. If you are fortunate, you may see some Indians on this low ground cultivating their gardens. And if it's in September, they may be harvesting their corn or their pumpkins or their squash, because that's where Chief Okemos had their tribe of Peace Okemos had their summer garden and lived there in those shelters that were built up against the high bank. But you look over to your left, there's a brand new log cabin. Sanford Marsh moved his family into this little log cabin in September 1839. It was the only cabin for many miles in any direction. And can you imagine how you must have felt? Felt just all cut off from any contact. But you did have a contact, because on the other side of the river and on the high ground, there was a sort of a road that had been built, and it was called the Military Road. It followed pretty generally what Hamilton Road follows. 5 years before Mr. Marsh came, before Michigan was a state, the government had commissioned some men to build a road from Detroit to Lake Michigan by the way of Grand Rapids. It was supposed to be cleared at a space of 100 feet wide. All they did, really, was just to cut down the trees and to get rid of the trees, but left the stumps right there. If there were some mud holes, something like that, they didn't bother to fill them in. If they were really swampy, they put some logs in. That was the kind of road that they had at that time. And that is probably the road that Mr. Marsh's family came up to their place. Well, that was in September that he came. And then in March, or December, Joseph Kilburn came. Now, Joseph Kilburn had a brother-in-law called Freeman Bray. And they wanted to go into some new country and establish a sawmill. And so Joseph was walking along the Red Cedar River to find a place where the fall of the water was sufficient to make a good sawmill. And he liked what he saw there on the bend of the river where Ferguson Park is. So he appropriated or asked the government for land, and they got a large acreage of land in Freeman Bray's name. Then he went back down south of Michigan and got his wife and his mother and his sister and her husband, Freeman Bray. And they came up and they lived in the Marsh House while the men built a log cabin. This is Clinton Road out here, isn't it? The log cabin that the Bray's family built was built at the end of Clinton Road, at the east end, on that high bank on the river. And because these men were good businessmen, they knew that sooner or later, there were going to be landlookers come through looking for land. So they built a big enough cabin so they could take care of people overnight. Also, they stocked up with beads and trinkets and gunpowder and calico. What do you suppose they were going to do with that? They were going to trade with the Indians. They wanted the furs and the hides that the Indians were bringing, and they would trade some of the furs for a piece of calico or some pretty beads or something of that type. So Mr. Freeman Bray was really the first businessman in Okemos. But he also had a dream. He could see that there could be a nice village laid out on his land, and so he planted a part of his farm, and he called the future village Hamilton. He planted it all along the military road out to where the old cemetery is now, and he went east about where Marsh Road is, and he went south just across the river. Wasn't long before some friends of his wanted to come to Okemos. So he drove with wagon and team to Detroit, and he brought back the Barnes family. The Barnes family settled about where Knob Hill Apartments are now, at the south of Okemos, and that's as far as the trail went. The road went. There was no road, at that time, no road. There were just Indian trails. And so the Barnes family were at the end of civilization down at that way. Soon there was another family came in by the name of Turner. And that name is very familiar to all of us because Jesse Turner was a descendant of this family. They went to the north side of the river and the military road, and they settled just east of Marsh Road. And then in the Bascom family. The Turners had a little girl, Mary, and when she grew up, she was a very lovely lady, and she lived to be 90 years old. And everybody in the village loved to call her Aunt Mary Youngs. I know there are some people here today that are familiar with that name. Then the Bascoms came in, and they had two children. They had Willie and Mary Ann. In the meantime, this is maybe about 4 or 5 years later, Freeman Bray folks had two little girls, Caroline, whose picture is back there, and that Mr. Freeman Bray is the man, that's it. And then they had a little girl, Susan. So they thought, well, with these children, we'd ought to start a school. But where to have this school? And then they found out that a man that lived about 2 miles east had a cooper shop. Do any of you know what a cooper does? Well, he makes barrels. And he makes wooden pails and boxes. thing that you used to store things in your house. So he was quite a practical man and quite necessary. But he had room, he had an extra room in his building where they could have a school. So then they hired Miss Samantha Warden, and we're going to pay her $1 a week to teach school. Now, they had just three children. There was Mary and Willie and Charlotte Gray, and they needed five children. So they, Gray's had a little three-year-old Susan, and Bascom's had three-year-old Mary Ann. So the little three-year-old children went with the other children, and they walked all night to their school. That's our walk, isn't it? Well, after a couple of years, people kept coming into one family after another, until there was quite a string of houses around, and quite a few more children. So they decided it was time to build a school, a real schoolhouse. So they paid Mr. Gray $15 for a piece of ground, and they built a little one-room school. But they had it fixed with folding doors in it, so they could make two rooms, so they could open it up and make one big room. That school is right where we are tonight. This is the site of the first school. After a long time, quite a long time, that school was torn down, and the two-story school was... I thought there was a picture of it here.
Is it here by any chance?
Well, I don't know if you can see this or not, but it was a two-story school that they built on this site here. This is a picture of the little cooper shop where the first children went to school. Then in 1893, that was a long ways afterwards, they built another school at the side of it for the small children, and they called that the little school or the primary school. And those buildings stood there then until the town decided to have a fire department and a library, and they built this down and built this building. So you can see that you are right where the children started in school so long ago. Enough about that for the schools. It's said, you know, that a pioneer, when he went into the frontier, he took with him three things: his axe, his saw, and his Bible. And that was true with these pioneer people. Their first consideration was to get shelter for their family, get the ground cleared so that they could plant some food, plants. You see, they had to cut down trees because there was a dense forest, and that ground had to be cleared, and it was a couple of years before they would get much use out of the ground. But they also wanted to have their children have religious nurture, and so they early, in about 1840, organized a religious society, and they had their meetings and worship service and their songs and their prayers and their Bible readings in homes. Then when they built this new school standing here, then they said, well, now we can have our church services in the school. And so for many, many years, until after the Civil War, that's where they had their church services, because the churches were not built in Okemos until after the Civil War. While we were talking about the people that were right in the village here, we must also remember that all around this area there were farms being developed. The road to the south is the Barnes family, and that's as far as that road went. It didn't go way down to Jolly Road like it does today. To the east, there was a road that went south, and it was called Barney Road. Later, it was called Dobie Road, and that's the road that I live on now. Ralph Kelly brought me a very lovely picture tonight. This is a house that stood on Dobie Road. It was first a log house, and then there was an addition built to it. Then the log house was torn down, and an upright built to it. This is across from John Rittenberger's farm, and is the home of Dr. Sanders now. And that family was from my husband's mother's people. Oh, there were a number of girls in the family, five girls, and most of them, I think, were born in that log house. Further down on Dobie Road were a couple other farms. And about 2 or 3 miles down was the Stillman farm. And also, there were some other names that were familiar to maybe some of you. There was the Dobie farm that was on that road. There was the Wilkins farm. There was the Rathburns. All of them came in about the same time, 1840 and 41. All of these people had about the same home life because it was different, you know, living in a log cabin away from everything that they had probably been accustomed to. Mostly, they tried to build their house near a spring. I know that was the case with the Stillman family. They built at the edge of the swamp where the Indian Trail, which is called the Dexter Trail, went through, but there were a number of springs there because it was much easier to get water from a spring than it was to dig a well. But there was no place around to get crude ground or wheat ground. You had to go to Dexter or to Detroit, which was a 4 weeks trip. So after Mr. Freeman Gray had built a sawmill, then just north of the sawmill was on the, about, you know, at the Ferguson Park that it makes a bend and goes under the bridge. Well, just a little ways east of the bridge was the sawmill. Then up nearer the houses was the grist mill. We have some pictures of the grist mill here that you can see later on. And that was a good thing for the farmers because they could now take their wheat to Okemos and get flour made and so forth. So there were two businesses. Then as the people came in and moved into Okemos, there were other businesses. And I have a list here of some of the things that were in Okemos. Quite different from what our business is today. There were two hotels. Now somebody here, who was it now, tell me that Sheik is a descendant of one of the people that kept the Thurber Hotel. And that is a, isn't that the Breckenfeld? Isn't that the Thurber? To begin with?
Barnes and
And it was a Turner that built it. And then there was another hotel up near where the Lynns lived. Another one beside the Antel Hall where the Tiffany Travel Agency was now. We've talked about the Cooper Shaft and the sawmill, the Ferguson Park, and the grist mill. And then down on the flats, back at the Masonic Temple, there was a mill for the man that by the name of Davis had made wooden things. He made handles for brooms, for axes, for hoes, anything along that kind. And he had a steam affair that so he could bend the wood, make runners for the sleighs and so forth. And then there were blacksmiths. Today we have gas stations, don't we? And service people to take care of our car. But then they had blacksmiths that took care of your horses. And there were several blacksmith shops in Okemos. Then up on Marsh Road a little ways, there was a wagon shop that made wagons and a buggy shop that would paint your buggy to order. You could have whatever colored stripes you wanted on your buggy. Isn't that something? Well, most of these men that came in were farmers, but almost every farmer had another trade. Daniel Stillman was a brickmaker, and brick were made on the back of our farm. Mr. Turner was a
fine casket maker. He sold or made black wild cherry caskets for $6. Your casket usually was not made ahead of time. He might have one on hand, but many times he made a casket for the occasion. Then Mr. Barnes is also a cabinet maker. His specialty was chairs. Mr. Turner also made some lovely tables, and there are a number of homes in Okemos that are proud owners of a table made by Mr. Turner. Then there was a Mr. Edgerly, who made chests, and I have one of his chests, you know, with these little drawers up on the top. It has three kinds of wood in it, chestnut and oak and walnut, all local wood that they had. But they had fun, too. They had singing schools. Everybody went and spent a happy evening singing. They had spell downs. Do you know what a spell down is? Well, that's when you have people line up. One line of people here, another line here. And then somebody says, use your first one, they give a word, and they all might say maybe basket. And you spell basket. And if you missed it, the person on the other line said spell basket, and then you had to sit down. And they kept that up until there was just one person left standing up who was the winner of the spell down. Then another very popular one was geography schools. You see, people didn't have a chance to travel then. Very few of them had maps. A great many of them did not have any books. So they would have someone come in with a big map, and they would have what they call geography schools. I can remember Ralph Spillman telling that his father said that when Leek School got their map, it was really an occasion. People came from all over to that geography school to study the map. They also had lectures, serious lectures. They had debates. And they had sugar off, maple sugar. When these people came in, the ground wasn't ready to use, and so they had to have something to bring in money. And there were a lot of maple trees here. And so they made maple sugar. And they bartered that for their groceries and so forth, even for their postage on their letters. I have a letter here written by Sarah Chatterton, who lived over near Hagedorn and Grand River Corners. And she said that they made 300 pounds of sugar that winter. So they would, at the end of the sugar season, they usually have a party, and they'd have biscuits and warm syrup. Have a good time, party. Then, had other kinds of fun that they did. They went to Mason to listen to the court proceedings. Orlando Hillman, I have a diary here that he wrote 130 years ago today, January the 30th. I went to Mason with a load of wheat this day. January 31st, went to Meridian to a lawsuit. There was a little town at Meridian. On Meridian Road, where the railroad track crosses Meridian Road, about half a mile north of Jolly Road, there was a post office, a depot, and some stores. February the 1st, cold. Went to Okemos with a load of hay. February the 2nd, cold. Drawed home some clover seed. He didn't say where he got the clover seed. Went to a raising. That was probably a barn raising. At night, I went to Okemos to a show. Now, this was 10 years after Marsh came into Hope, and they were having shows. So you see that that little town, that little village grew very, very rapidly. Some of the things that they had to do that your mother and your daddies don't have to do now was make all their clothes. They had to spin their wool, and they had to weave it, and then make the cloth, and then they had to cut out the garments, and they had to sew. And a little girl, from 5 years old, had to learn to sew. I have here some quilts that were made by a little girl, and she was 5 years old. Every night, every day, she had to make some of that sewing. She didn't like it very well because her brothers didn't have to do it. Now, the place where you got your heat, where you did your cooking, was the fireplace. That was the central warming place of the house, one-room cabin usually. And if you let the fire go out, you were just in bad luck. And then one time, the neighbors north of us, for some reason or other, they let their fire go out. So they had to send their little girl down with a tin pan to get some coals from the Stillman fireplace so they could light their fireplace. Evidently, they didn't have tinder or whatever it is to light fireplaces with. Some of the people had glass windows. Well, most of them had greased paper to let the light through. You couldn't see through it, but the light came through. Then there were the wild animals that they had to cope with, especially fox and wolves. And Mrs. Barnes tells about she was going up to visit Mrs. Marsh, and she had just this little narrow path that she was walking through, and pretty soon she saw something there in the bushes, and it was a wolf just keeping right along with her. The faster she went, the faster the wolf went. And she arrived at Mrs. Marsh's all out of breath because she had ran the rest of the space. But so it was, people were afraid of those wolves because they were anxious to get the pigs and calves and so forth. I have with me tonight someplace. Oh, here. This is what children used in school to write on. I have a slate pencil here, too. Do you remember seeing a slate pencil? Somebody else set this up for me. Well, anyway, you had a slate pencil, and you wrote your name on it. This is the boys in den number one. I don't remember who the den mother is, but they were at my house, and they wrote their names. So they used a slate because paper was very, very precious. And the slate, you can just have you got your name on it. You just see, and you just wipe it off. Then you could use it over again. But I suppose that we wouldn't be having the name of Okemos here if it wasn't for Chief Okemos. So I'd like to stop for my little talk telling a little bit about Chief Okemos. He's on the back of your picture, on the back of your little booklet that you have. That's the picture that was taken of him just a year before he died. Nobody knew just how old Chief Okemos was, but they do know that he was alive when George Washington was president. And he fought with the French against the British. And then when the British got the advantage of the French, then he fought with the British against the Americans. And then finally, he didn't fight the Americans anymore. he was in a lot of battles, and he bore some scars that lasted all his lifetime, and one of them had never healed properly. He was left for dead one time on a battlefield. He was very proud of his successes in fighting, and that was the reason that he was called the chief of his tribe, because that term chieftain was not inherited or given to you by someone else, except the tribe honored you because of some valid thing that you had done or your way of life that was
a little above the rest of them. And so he became chief because of his valor in fighting. After the war of 1812, he went to Detroit, and he signed a peace treaty there in which he said that he would no more fight, that the white man was too much for him, and he wanted peace. And so he signed that treaty for his tribe, and the tribe always kept that treaty. They never violated it or broke it, which I'm afraid is a little different than what some other treaties have been violated. Chief Ogamas was welcomed in almost all the homes, and Indians had a feeling that if you had a house, then you were welcome there. You just walked in, you didn't knock. And in our house, there had been Indians that came in at night, wrapped up in a blanket, laid down in front of the fireplace, went to sleep, got up in the morning and left. But invariably, when they came in the house, they expected something to eat. And they would sit down at the table and expect the housewife to give them something to eat. Chief Ogamas, on this knocking business, I don't remember the man that chided him. He said, you shouldn't walk in houses like that. American people knock before they come in. So the next time Chief Ogamas came to visit him, he knocked and walked right in. He said, me knock this time. He didn't quite get the point, but he did knock. Chief Ogamas had one son that became a farmer over by Stanton. He had another son that he said was no good Indian. He was sort of a ne'er-do-well. He had a daughter that died, and they had a funeral for her, or the ceremony that they went through on the Red Cedar River, and her body was put upon a canoe and taken up towards Ionia for burial. Thelma Lamb has written a book about Chief Ogamas. I think it's probably the most complete account of Chief Ogamas. Thelma has spent many days doing research work, and it's a book that I think a lot of you probably own, and it tells so many stories about Chief Ogamas that I think you would enjoy reading it. He died up near around Flint and DeWitt, rather, and was buried up near Portland. He died on December the 5th in 1858. Now, even though Mr. Bray had put the name Hamilton on this village, people didn't use that word. You notice that in this diary, Orlando says he goes to Ogamas. People were calling it Ogamas, in spite of the fact that Mr. Bray wanted it Hamilton. So the year after Chief Ogamas died, the settlers petitioned the legislature to make the name official, the word Ogamas, the name Ogamas official for this area. And so that way, then the post office was no longer Sanford, but Ogamas. So that's very briefly, I think, what gives you a little bit of an idea, maybe, of the starting subject. I don't know whether you want to ask any questions or whether you just want to see these things. I'd like to, if you'd like to see them, I think.
Are there any questions for Ruth?
All right, Loretta.
I'd like to know, you said they would come into Oklahoma to a show. What type of show did they have?
I don't know. I maybe it was a hometown. I don't know.
She asked what type of a show they might have come into Oklahoma to see, and Ruth said she doesn't know. Man didn't tell in his diary.
I expect it was maybe a hometown, and still they might have had people come in from away, but as early as this one, this was written in 1850, I doubt whether there were troops coming through.
Was there another question?
Somebody wanted to know what kind of a tribe.
What tribe Chief Ogamas belonged to?
Ottawa and Chippewa. His father
His father was a Chippewa. I believe his mother was an Ottawa. But they also were linked up with the Potawatomis. But there were the three. You see, in that Saginaw and that part of Michigan, in the Saginaw area, there were these three tribes. And they integrated a lot. So that they were not pure one thing or the other.
Thank you very much for joining us.